find us. Learn about station news, find out about recommended events, and see what we're talking about, whether it be news, interviews, or music.
Kibu Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pan-African film series hosted by the All African People's Revolutionary Party. The film this month is Assata Shakur Talks About Socialist Development in Cuba, showing Wednesday, March 30th at 6 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union in room 236. The former Black Panther and member of the Black Liberation Army, who has had political asylum in Cuba since 1984, talks about socialist practices in Cuba, racism, patriarchy, and the way forward for socialist politics. Again, that's Assata Shakur Talks About Socialist Development in Cuba, Wednesday, March 30th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union in room 236 at Portland State University, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yes, you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And by True West, presenting Grateful Dead tribute band Dark Star Orchestra in a two-night stand at the Crystal Ballroom, Friday, April 1st and Saturday, April 2nd. Tickets and information for two nights with Dark Star Orchestra on April 1st and 2nd are available at CascadeTickets.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guest today is launching a program that, if fully embraced, would bring atmospheric CO2 levels back to what they were, maybe not quite in the 1700s, but in the early 1800s, I just learned. And it would also do a lot more. It would restore our soil, provide us with food and materials, mitigate pollution, and generate a different way of how we do business with each other. Sort of social aspects would be taken care of too. Jordan Fink is here with me in the studio to talk about how he is founding the World Tree. And he's also here with Daniel Lurch, who's the publication director of Post Carbon Institute. The two of them are friends going way back to the city repair days here in Portland over a decade ago. And Daniel's going to be talking about his insights with all this and some of the roles that cities can play. So Jason and Daniel, Jordan. Jason. Anyway, Jordan and Daniel, I want to welcome you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Jordan. Okay. So scientists are saying that what we're going through right now is the most extreme global warming event in something like 66 million years. I just read this a couple days ago. In fact, 66 million years ago, there was a period where the amount of CO2 being emitted annually was a billion tons a year. Now it's over 10 billion tons a year. Being emitted annually, and we're human beings are doing this, it's unprecedented, but you say that we could actually get carbon levels back to what they were in the early 1800s by putting soil back into the soil. This is a very real thing, right, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, we've known a lot of this for a while, and we're getting to the point where we have enough proofs of concept that we're going to be able to do this if we have the cultural backing, if people are able to focus and make this happen.
So a lot of what this is about is getting people on board.
Well, yeah, and as I talk to people, so many people talk about climate despair.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways that is what's in the way of our work, that we can find hope because there's actually things we can tangibly do to move things forward, regardless of whether international agreements back us or not. And what we're trying to do with the World Tree is restore the actual way that the planet has stored carbon over time. With that back in place, we can get back on track.
So it's kind of like we become animals again, that like animals that live in the woods, that, you know, everything that we're doing is, you know, putting stuff back into the soil, compost, whatever.
But I think we can do this with a complicated culture.
Our
cities, our towns, our homes, our businesses, all those things can contribute to a healthy ecology.
We'd still have our houses. We'd still have our cities. We'd still have everything that we have. And somehow...
I don't know about everything. I don't know about everything. We have a really big challenge ahead of us. But I think we can have a quality of life. And I think that we can find and negotiate together what things we'll keep.
So... And I remember I did interview you a couple of years ago with Kristen Olson.
Yeah, that was a great conversation.
The author of Soil Will Save Us. Yeah, I loved that book. So is that where you got the origins of World Tree, or where did you get this idea for World Tree?
Well, I've been exploring questions of how do we actually make a difference on this planet since I was a teenager growing up in Portland. The movement in the 90s here in Portland of strong environmentalists and ecologists and people thinking about voluntary simplicity, all that work. And that's actually when Daniel and I met back in the 90s, mm-hmm. trying to work together on helping neighbors find community together.
Yep, at a city repair potluck.
And for me at the time, I discovered permaculture and I discovered the works of Howard Odum, the systems ecologist, and started to understand a little bit more about where carbon in our atmosphere, the extra carbon, is coming from. And began to start to think about what it might take for us to get there. And it's taken me about 20 years of talking and meeting and connecting with other people who have had similar questions.
Yeah.
And just this year, we've gotten to the point where we feel comfortable in launching something creative that could address some of these issues.
And so basically, what is it that we're doing now that's going to have to change?
Yeah. We're going to have to rethink a lot of things. So... the soil ecologist, David Montgomery, says that if you look at the way we run agriculture, is that we generally have erosion that's at a rate equal to what's in alpine environments. And what that means is that for every little bit of soil production, there's quite a bit of loss. We know that in the last 150 years, we've lost half of the world's soils. And the other fact I have here is that in the last 40 years, we've lost a fourth of the U.S.'s soils. There's a fourth of our farmland has had to be abandoned due to soil loss. And to understand why that's essential, you have to understand that soil is the main terrestrial storage of carbon on the planet. We have these giant storages in deep oil, and we have giant storages in the deep oceans. But they take millennia and millions of years to form. We can build soil very rapidly if we put our attention to it. And the soil ecologists I've talked with have said that we can attribute about half of the problem carbon in the air is due to the loss of soil.
Half of it.
So we could be at 350, that magic number that people talk about as being the last resort.
Right.
We would be at 350 if we hadn't been using the energy of oil to damage the landscape. And by damaging the landscape, we've caused so much erosion. We have half the oil left. We have half of the energy supply left. And we can use that to rebuild the infrastructure that builds soil.
And so basically what he's saying is that we're taking this soil out of the, I mean, we're like letting it just wash away. Is this, for instance, like why there used to be farms in New England and now there's not or something? Or
there's a great quote that I should have brought with me about George Washington saying, if people just took care of their land, they wouldn't have to keep moving.
Right.
And he was noticing that as the land quickly was degrading in New England at the time, that people were becoming itchy to move because they were degrading the soils. But even back then, they knew how to keep soils at least stable or at least minimize the decline, and they weren't taking responsibility.
Right.
So westward expansion is in a lot of ways triggered, and that colonial impulse is triggered by the fact that a civilization rises, uses up half of its soils, and then starts feeling the strain.
Yeah, and you were saying that takes like something like 1,000 years, actually. But the U.S. seems like we're doing it in the space of 200 years or something.
Yeah, and we're also have to view ourselves as a you know, an outpost of Western civilization, you know, ever since the Renaissance. We're still part of that culture.
Right.
And the other way of thinking about it is that the we got into a bit of a mess that we weren't in before. Agriculture itself is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? It uses the energy in soil to undermine soil. So that takes about 1,000 years. But what we discovered was how to use oil. And I have a statistic right here that I find fascinating, which is if you look at all the crude oil that we've already used, that's 944 billion barrels of crude oil have been used since the Industrial Revolution began. And that's the equivalent energy of 91 million Hiroshima bombs going off.
Wow.
And at the rate of crude oil use we have right now, that's 87 million barrels a day. That's the equivalent of 8,496 Hiroshima bombs going off every single day worth of energy.
Blasting our soil.
Blasting our soil, flinging cars down the streets, lighting this radio studio, fusing ores, making plastics, feeding us. We are in the middle of a long, slow explosion. We're halfway through that explosion. And that is what has been hitting the planet over and over again for hundreds of years now.
Wow.
Or 100 years now, really.
Yeah, that's an incredible image, if you think about it. But
that's also where the hope is, because we have some of that energy. And if we put it towards cleaning up our messes, if we do the dishes after the meal, basically, if we put away the toys before we get sleepy, we have the capacity to make better decisions while we still have an energy supply. And those decisions can lead to long-term repair of the planet and short-term rapid soil building.
So you're saying that actually to repair the soil, we still need to be using oil.
I don't think we need to be using oil the way we've been using it at all. Uh-huh. The oil that we're currently using, we keep using for really secondary products. It's a mistake to use that oil to get into the coal. That's not going to be a good return for us, and it's going to cause more problems. It's really not a good idea for us to waste oil fracking, because we're not getting back as much energy as it took to put into that system. It's a product, not an energy source. So we have to think about what we're doing with that oil. The other thing to think about is, because half of the carbon problem is from soil loss, it means the problem has been the energy in the oil more than the carbon in the oil.
The energy in the oil more than the carbon in the oil.
If we had left the soils alone, or had even worked towards repairing them or making them stronger, going to places that never had good soil and making it stronger, we could have mitigated all of the CO2 problems that we were creating. We could have gone out of this mess. But instead, it's like we've been damaging the support system of the planet. So unless we fix that, we're really going to keep going into the same problem. But we feel like there's hope that human beings can make fundamental changes.
And do you have a comment on this, Daniel?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it might help to maybe go over the very, very briefly the mechanics of what we're talking about. So when we burn fossil, the way that we use fossil fuels in this society, like Jordan's talking about, so when you burn some oil, carbon is released. So carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere as well as a bunch of other things. And we can also, when we burn that oil, we can use it to do work. We can use it to move a car down the road. We can use it to build structures, and we can use it to power machinery, for example, to till the earth, which is how we got to mechanized agriculture and the so-called Green Revolution from back in the 60s. So what Jordan's talking about is whereas before the Industrial Revolution, we were farming the soil basically using animal muscle, whether it was our own or slaves, other people's muscle, or animals. And when we're in farming that soil, the carbon that is tied up in that soil gets released. And there's the chemistry of that Jordan can speak to that I'm not so familiar with. So the point is that if what happened with the Industrial Revolution, and especially in the last, since the post-World War II period, we've been using these hydrocarbon fuels of mostly oil, but also natural gas and coal, to mechanize the process of farming. So by doing that, we're not only emitting carbon by burning the fuels, we're also emitting carbon by using that machinery to dig up the soil faster, to till it faster in a greater quantities. In some of the reports that we've done recently at Post Carbon Institute, I've been using this juxtaposition of images of, say, an oxen pulled farm equipment versus oil powered farm equipment, modern machinery, and the difference is striking. You can just imagine how much faster and how much what greater extent of land we can process, essentially. We can disturb using oil. So it's that much more carbon that's going to the atmosphere, both from burning and from disturbing the soil.
The carbon gets released through soil disturbance then. Exactly. Basically how I'm understanding it. Yeah.
And Jordan, maybe I think it would be really helpful if you could just like maybe explain really briefly what exactly is happening there in terms of the soil chemistry. I'm not even entirely sure.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's actually been some revelations in the last few years about, we used to think of soil as a process where, well, let's give an example. So a landscape like the prairies of the Oklahoma Panhandle for millennia, and where the plants were taking in sunlight and using that energy to store CO2 in their bodies. They took about half to 80%, depending on the plant, of that energy, and they put it into their root systems in the form of sugars, carbohydrates, and proteins, the things you'd make cake and cookies with.
Yeah.
And they took most of that energy and they put it into the soil to feed microorganisms that then mine the soil and pull resources and nutrients back up to the plant. Now, if you've ever seen some of the cutaways that are out there of looking at prairie soils, the root systems of perennial grasses can go down 50, 80, 100 feet. It's
grass
incredible.
With a 100-foot root.
Some of the old perennial grasses can live up to 500 years.
Wow.
When you're looking at an intact native prairie, you're looking at an old-growth system.
And so part of this is what we talked about a few years ago with Kristen Olson, is you don't till. There is no tilling going on with that kind of
There's a kind of tilling we can do, and it's a big change in how we do it. So what we've been doing is so the system puts all that sugar, protein, and carbohydrates into the bodies of microorganisms, and they hold it in. They hold it in the ground, and they build an increasingly complex storage of thick, rich carbon. We're also learning in the last few years that char and charcoal and the results of fire are also an essential component to give little spots for these organisms to live and work together. So we know that soil production requires also infrequent but deliberate, sometimes, fire.
Right.
So those organisms are holding that in their bodies. But when you come and you want to feed plants quickly, you come and you till. You turn the soil over. And that kills off the microorganisms.
Also,
and they release
those root systems.
Yep. But they release nutrients when they die.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants grow really abundant in a very short period. And so we've been doing that over and over
again.
That's
our farming system. I just pause a moment here and let people know you're tuned to KBOO Portland, and this is the Recovery Zone. I'm talking with Jordan Fink, founder of World Tree, and Daniel Lurch, publications director for the Post Carbon Institute. If you have any comments or questions, you can call in too. Just here at KBOO, the number is 503-231-8187. So in other words then, that our farming gives us a bunch of food fast, but in the long run, it's really disturbing the soil. It's releasing carbon out of the soil, and it's not a healthy way to be doing what we're doing.
Well, I think the example that you gave of thinking of the prairie grass ecosystem as an old growth system is really apt, because I mean, imagine before the westward expansion of the Europeans on this continent, you had these massive grasslands all throughout the Great Plains that were basically essentially these old growth systems with these massive root systems,
right.
Very old. The Europeans come in, we tear that all out, and we tear out these perennial grasses and replace them with annual wheat crops that
so
require tilling
have
every single year.
Lived on those grasses? I mean, is there a way we could have lived doing that instead?
We could not live on those grasses, as far as I know. I think they were inedible, but it's an interesting question because there are, in fact, people working on that problem. It's a fellow named Wes Jackson, who actually, I think he just retired this year or last year, with the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. It has been working for decades now on developing perennial wheat. So basically, we tore out the old perennial grasslands and replaced them with annual wheat, which has a much, much, much shorter root system and is only there for a year. So they've been trying to develop wheat in a perennial form so that it has that long root system and you don't need to till it every single year. And that then is a crop that we can eat.
So in other words, that direction is the kind of direction we need to go.
We also need to remember that those landscapes were inhabited by people who lived there fine. They lived there with off of the bison.
Yeah, oh, we have a question?
I just got paused for, I got quiet for a second. So we, you know, they lived off of the bison and the buffalo. They lived off of all of the different foods. Here in the Pacific Northwest, our prairie environments have tarweed, which
is
an edible seed.
And I heard that actually there were a lot more Indians than we want to think. There's actually millions and millions of Indians here.
The evidence right now, and from both oral and archaeological records, show that North America had a population of at least the same size as Europe in the 1400s.
Wow.
Is there 30 million or so?
Like that, yeah. And so that means a very large die-off because of the behaviors of colonists.
Yeah.
But keep in mind, so they weren't living in high densities in the Great Plains. I mean, that was a hunting and foraging culture.
It depends on where you are. So like when you finally go to, you know, some of the forested landscapes in, you know, the Illinois River Valley, then you get into some cities that rival the cities that were in Europe at the time. But other places in the continent, yeah, there's different types of behavior that you have to live in different places. And there are people talking about what it would actually take to bring back buffalo to the Great Basin.
Uh-huh.
You need giant herds wandering. But I'm just using that as an example, because when you look at the history of westward expansion, after the World Wars, the United States was industrialized at a whole new level.
Right.
And so we took that oil and we used it to send out people to till up the Great Plains.
Started dropping our oil bombs.
That's right. Yeah. And the result was that in a very short amount of time, a lot of people moved because of the boom in crops. And then there was a drought. In the 1930s, that soil all blew away. Dust clouds in 1934, making all the way to Washington, D.C.
And that was, again, carbon into the atmosphere.
It was all carbon.
Yeah.
And I've been more careful about exact statistics, but we know that the scale of the soil loss and carbon loss that happened due to the Dust Bowl was about the same as the release of fossil fuels due to the use of motor vehicles that have happened since the Industrial Revolution.
We do have a caller. Dennis, would you like to ask your question?
Yes, I would. A friend of mine, whom I went to college with, to Reed College right here in Portland, his name was David Coleman, and he went into soil ecology, and he wrote the book on, he and another person, I mean, he did a tremendous amount of work. I wondered if you had ever heard of him. David Corin Coleman, and he co-authored Fundamentals of Soil Ecology. I mean, this is long ago. But I just wondered if you ever heard of that work and of David's work, because it's been, he's written hundreds of papers on that subject.
Hmm. Is he anybody familiar to you guys?
I don't know him in particular, but I have read The Fundamentals of Soil Ecology. That's one of the, like, prime texts.
Oh, cool.
That's right. Thank you. That was my question.
Oh, nice to hear that came from here in Portland.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
All sorts of great things come out of Reed.
Yeah. Including me.
Okay. So that's a lot of information to digest, but I think that if you look at the Dust Bowl and you understand that boom of human effort was not sustainable for us. We had the Great Depression, even though we were having all of this expansion, and we were in a time where high lack of employment and a destruction of the environment and a giant release of carbon. And at that time, there was at least enough will to set up the New Deal, a new relationship between how people work together and how they treated the land and how they took responsibility for their collective needs.
Right.
And that's failed us now. We're at a point where we are no longer embracing that. People were talking about Bernie Sanders in the show before this, and he keeps evoking Roosevelt. And Roosevelt helped set up the CCC, the Soil Conservation Corps, the Citizen Conservation Corps, excuse me. And they did so much work in a very short period of time, putting people back to work to repair the soil.
Yeah, and that's actually an issue. You're saying, like I saw that on your website, that and I was reading what you were saying too. We can't count on the government, even if Bernie Sanders got elected with what the gridlock and all of that. We can't count on big government, the whole federal system, to pull us out of this. But you're talking a lot more about how we can count on small communities, cities, just neighborhoods, even. Like, that's how you see the systems changing in a way.
Oh boy. Well, now we're getting into the scale issues. I think I would find it actually helpful to maybe, because I think what Jordan talks about is like this really large scale stuff, and that's important. I think if he sets the scale of what needs to happen in terms of soils, then we can maybe a bit later we can get into the communities,
because across the country and actually across around the whole world, you know.
Yeah, because there's a lot of different things. I think we need to have things happening at all scales. And one of the things that we talk about at Post Carbon Institute is this idea of resilience, but particularly community resilience. The idea the way that we look at it is that we've got these global crises. We call them the E4 crises, the ecological crisis, the energy crisis, the equity crisis, and the economic crisis. And we need to be, and these are crises, crisis in this, we use that word specifically because these are things, they're not just big challenges, but these are things that are pushing us to a decisive moment, to a decisive tipping point.
Right.
So we need to address those at all levels. And we've obviously seen, I think it's been to the dismay of the environmental community for the last 40, 50 years, although we keep seeming to not learn the lesson that we can't count on international and national efforts to save the day. So, you know, therefore, we do need to be working at the local level. The Transition Town movement, right, that's been up the last 10 years or so, the relocalization movement that's been a big part of that. City repair here in Portland in the late 90s getting started was one of the early manifestations
even
of that.
Even a long time ago, think globally, act locally.
Yeah, it reaches back to all that. So all those things are important, and they're changing and they're developing. And yet at the same time, and this is why I think it's so important and interesting what Jordan is saying, is that we do need to be have things happening at the national and the international levels. But it might not necessarily be government doing it. And so this...
Then
this,
what would be doing it?
Well, this is where WorldTree comes in.
So we're tackling this issue on two fronts. And so far we've talked about the first side, which is, you know, if we're going to be putting a lot of human effort into something, we need to understand where we're going. And so the question of what will it actually take to put 100 parts per million back into the soil is the guiding question. And it's how do we get somewhere? And, you know, as I go around giving presentations and talking about WorldTree, and when people... come to my website and write us questions. What they're always seem to be asking is either the question of, it's so big, how do we move on it?
Yeah.
Or how do we do this if the Paris Accords don't go through? Or how do we do this if there's if government won't set up a cap and trade system or those kinds of things?
Yeah, that's my whole wanting to weep feeling.
What we've realized is that we first of all have to figure out a way to do this that is through collective action, and the best way to do that is that people come together and start on small projects incrementally and grow from there. So the other side of WorldTree is not the large scale. That's our guiding force. That's where we're aimed. But what we are doing is forming small worker cooperatives that do design and development, that transform landscape. We take investment, we buy land, we put it in, we get it, or we work with people who have land in trust, and we redesign that land to be carbon sequestering. And it turns out that carbon is actually a great indicator of the health of all sorts of other systems. If a society is building soil, you know that it's on a good track. So it says something about the kinds of relationships between people. It says something about the kind of relationships between agriculture and people. It says something about the way that people manage and think in the long run. So if soil is an indicator of health, what's the healthy system that we can build that will build soil? And we think that it's possible to create human communities, residences, urban environments, small ones, medium mm-hmm. ones, maybe some large ones, we'll see. But we think that the design processes that have been developed over the last 40 years for thinking about soil production can be applied to the regular, everyday built environment. And when we design our everyday, regular lives to be carbon sequestering, then we have a chance here. And so how do you form small worker cooperatives that can work together, that can take care of individual sites? The real big problem is that so many of these projects that are currently out in the world repairing the soil, they're isolated, they're alone. And when they go to a place, it takes a lot of work to start a project. And we don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And working together allows us to collectively build resources and allows us to scale up at the scale that is the international scale, but it's done through individual human connections to each other in the land.
Yeah. And so, for instance, like when I remember interviewing you with Kristen Olson, it seemed like there were these like test plots happening, and the soil was becoming remarkably green. It was holding more water because I guess those microbes were able to hold air pockets, create air pockets that water would absorb into that to deal with droughts. But so you're saying though that these people doing those like test projects in a way are feeling more isolated, and that somehow you want the city of Portland maybe or something like that really involved with it too, or co-ops, communities, lots of people involved.
Well, I think a good example of good intentions not always going the way that we would hope is if you look at the Damascus plan that happened a few years ago, the development that was trying to happen out near Happy Valley in Damascus. They tried uh-huh. to turn that into a small city. And you look at the plan and they did a really good job of preserving riparian zones. They did a really good job of preserving the forests at the top of hills.
Uh-huh.
But they put all of the urban development right in the lowlands, which is where the soil gets built and where the soil is stored.
Where you might actually farm, for instance.
And if you look at deep history, you can look at medieval hill towns in the Mediterranean, like Italy, where their choices were to actually build the streets and the cities up in the mid-ranges, up in the hilly lands. And then they used that to collect water into the roads and cisterns, and then they use that to irrigate the valleys. So you go to Tuscany, and the hills are the urban environments, and the lowlands are preserved for food production. And we can be doing exactly the same model of development. We could be working in the mid-ranges, preserving the mountains and those foothills as landscapes for ecology. But the valleys can be made into projects that are being restorative of the deep soils.
It's really taking lessons from history. I want to let listeners know again, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, and this is the Recovery Zone, and we're talking about recovering our entire planet in a whole beautiful way again, back to the old days in a way, with Jordan Frink, founder of World Tree, and Daniel Lurch, Publications Director for the Post Carbon Institute. If you'd like to call in with your questions and comments, the number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187.
So I think the example that Jordan gave just about the Italian hill towns is really essential for understanding the context and the importance of what he's talking about here. You know, there are practical reasons for having work done at the local level. It's not just feel good, you know, liberal hippie dumb, which we sometimes all get accused of.
Right.
You know, and so there's many ways to talk about that. You mentioned the in the 90s with the sustainability movement back then. So one of the great ideas to come out of the Earth Summit in the 1990s was this idea of think globally, act locally.
Right.
Well, there's actually some basis for that. And it kind of gets to one of the things, many things that Jordan and I talk about with common pool resources and management of ecological areas. We've learned over the last few decades that if you come in and you manage scientifically, you know, by trained people, a resource, whether it's like the North Atlantic fishery or a grassland or a forest, whatever, but you have outside experts coming in, crunching the numbers, making their observations and saying, okay, we're going to cut this number of trees this year. We're going to fish this number of fish this year. We're going to build this amount of soil this year. And we're going to do this in a way that is maximally sustainable. There are many problems with that. And one of the big problems is that you, by having outsiders come in and take control of all that, you lose that local knowledge. You lose that local history, like you just mentioned. You know, you can think of all sorts of examples about how that works. Resilience science, which has really been coming to the fore and coming into the mainstream for the last 15 years, talks a whole lot about that, about you have to have local stakeholders involved in order to get the best decisions, because they have knowledge, they have social relationships, they have connection to the history. They know what works, they know what doesn't. They have all these things that you simply cannot get from just looking from the outside. At the same time, you need to bring in outside experts so that you don't have a parochial view. So right. There's like this constant balance. Like you want to have the locals there, but you also want to have the Jordan Finks coming in who have this information about the science that the locals don't necessarily have.
Really,
and then they work together and they work in this method of it's called adaptive management. This stuff has exploded the last 10, 15 years about how we can do this. So that's the critical point of that is that this is why it can't just be a national or international program. You can't just have even President Sanders saying, okay, we're going to build soil carbon. So we're going to send out all these different people all across the country.
Right.
We're going to organize it from Washington, D.C. It's much, much more complicated than that, which is why we need these different models.
And that's what went wrong with the New Deal, too. Is in some ways the New Deal and the CCC was a period of top-down management. A lot of those people that worked in those work camps became the soldiers that went off for World War II. This is a top-down system. So if we're really going to create something that changes human relationships and makes us take responsibility, it needs to be very empowering to people.
Well, you mentioned just before we went on the air about the Mondragon system in Spain, and I was wondering, actually it's the but anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit and how that relates to maybe what you're trying to do.
Yeah, definitely. Wait a minute. So we were really inspired by Mondragon. And if you understand a little bit of the history of the Mondragon Cooperative, it ends up being a very interesting analog for us to think about.
By the way, I was there. It was great.
You got to go there?
Yeah.
It became a really interesting analog for us to look at. You know, they aren't exactly working on ecological repair, but they definitely come from a place of local knowledge. They began during the 50s, during the Franco regime, and there was a civil war in Spain. And the Basque were some of the population that really held out against Franco. And when they were conquered, they were not treated very well. They already were second-class citizens, you know, not part of the normal cultural Spanish people. And then they had opposed Franco. So a redistributionist priest, meaning he cared about food and clothing for people, taking care of people as his spiritual mission, set up an electrical engineering college in the 50s in Spain. And people who had done a good job there were eligible for joining a small worker cooperative. And they became, in just a few years, they are now the world's largest cooperative business, 70,000 worker owners.
And they have a lot of businesses, grocery stores, they make appliances. I mean,
they have funding systems, they do development, they have education, they have a college.
Right.
And one of the things that's really interesting about them is that, you know, they're Europe's second largest electrical engineering firm. Like they build most appliances that are produced in Europe. If you know Fager, the company, you see their signs all over Portland. They're coming out of Mondragon.
Wow!
But the neat thing about them is that everybody has a vote. Everybody has access. They do have an administration. They do have executives, but those are voted in and have elections. The top paid and lowest paid are a small percentage difference from each other. And so they're able to build solidarity.
I noticed is that it seemed like in the villages that I visited, especially the Mondragon village itself, people were all living basically the same. There wasn't like the big McMansions and then the hovels. It was just lots of just nice little apartment buildings, you know, where people lived, and there wasn't the billionaire class, you know, that we run into.
And when using an analog like that, it's really important to also look at what's problematic about those systems, that they definitely don't pollute their own environments, but where do they get their ores? Where do they get the materials? And do people really need a global enterprise creating appliances?
Right.
So I'm not necessarily saying that they're ideal about everything, but there's something about that economic model which allows for a bottom-up empowered way of doing things. And there's so many of us right now that are educated and working on projects towards repairing the planet, but we're scattered. How do we come together and actually work on something significant like repairing the planet? How do we do it in a cooperative way? And there's just great examples out there for how we can go there. You know, one other thing I wanted to say is that Daniel and I both came of age as organizers in city repair. And what we learned there, and Daniel can speak to this himself, is we learned in a lot of ways to lead by following. That if you want to create something in the world, you don't go in with your own idea of exactly what it looks like. You listen and you help empower people and give them options so that they can move on it. And when I was in school for a landscape architecture, we learned a model where the designer doesn't come in as the expert. The designer comes in as the facilitator. And so if you can really be a facilitator, then you're bottom up. You're listening to the grassroots, and your job is to reflect. Is this what you want? Is this what you need?
Right.
Here's a little bit of what other communities have been doing. Here's another way you can approach this. But being a galvanizing force and a focus point so that they can make better decisions together, that's the job of something like World Tree. It's not to be an imposing force, but to be something that allows people to lift up and make better decisions in their relationship to the environment.
But also to, I think there's this educational part to, people don't even realize, I think, a lot of people, going back to the soil, that how critical it is or how possible it is to get carbon back into it. And they're not going to ask you to do that if they don't even know about it.
Right.
You know.
So what we're doing is, first, we're starting as a nonprofit, and right now we're umbrellaed by the Cascadia Education Project, which is a great organization that's been around for, I think, 40 years now. And they're being our fiscal sponsor. And what we're doing for the first 6 months of our work is we are researching and making sure that all the information we have is available. We're teaching classes and doing workshops, and we're starting to put together a series of mapping criteria for thinking about where the best places are for this work. And in that way, we're doing research, we're doing development, and we're helping spread the word and let people know.
Mm-hmm.
And our hope is in a year or two to found a worker cooperative that's capable of actually going out and making these physical changes on the land. And those are the two arms of what we're trying to create.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long, I mean, how fast could this actually happen? I mean, if everybody got on board, I mean.
So I was just talking to the soil ecologist, Elaine Ingham, on the phone on email. And she was telling me that she thinks this can be done in 10 years if we have enough focus.
Wow.
And that's the time frame that we really have to be at to do this.
Oh, yeah. You're always hearing 10 years. Sometimes I'm wondering if 10 years is just getting pushed off to another 10 years, to another 10 years.
And that is a good point. Yeah. And I think, though, that has to do with thinking about how long it takes for forests to mature, how long it takes for ecological systems to mature.
Right.
We can accelerate succession through good design and through going out there. But to some degree, some of these things do take a good decade of work.
And we want to get those roots down 50 feet again, basically, is
exactly
what you're saying. Yeah.
And, you know, I think in some ways those 10 years are also about the human component. There's that idea that it takes 10,000 hours of focused effort to learn something and get good at it. That takes about 10 years for people to do that. And I think maybe 10 years is how long it takes for humans to get good at something.
Right. But, and also, though, like, we're dealing with a lot of people. I mean, are you just sort of, like, letting go of all the people who are, like, climate deniers? And, I mean, the people that just are, do you think that eventually the way that you're thinking is going to, like, the way everybody sort of believes in democracy now or something, I mean, would people all eventually come around to recognizing what you're saying?
Well, let's take the premise that we were trained to view hierarchical systems backwards, that nature operates from the bottom to the top. But for some reason, the people at the top have decided to trick us into thinking that they're the most influential ones.
Yeah.
We don't know our own power.
The microbes are actually the most influential.
The microbes and the chloroplasts in the plants are the ones that actually are calling the shots. There's that idea that I think it was Napoleon actually said that an army marches on its tummy or its belly, right? And it's like systems actually require flows of nutrients. They require carbon. The ecology actually operates by sunlight hitting plants and driving a whole system of processes. So a civilization that keeps changing its language, keeps changing its, you know, trying to make changes through symbols, that's powerful and galvanizing. But if you make changes in soil, you feed more people.
Right.
If you store water better, then people have more time on their hands. If you make it so that a community is more resilient to fire, or has less issues of drought, or is more locally secure, people have more time and energy on their hands. Just look at how hard it's been in Portland as housing prices have gone up for people to be volunteers in community organizations. The city had one of the highest instances of participation in the 90s and early 2000s. And as cost of living has gone up, people are scattering and moving farther and farther out because their rent is going up. When people's needs are taken care of, they flourish and they can take on higher order projects. So what I think is that we need to start taking care of each other and we need to start making good decisions now. And, you know, people who are really struggling and are afraid of how things are going in the world and they're not sure about this stuff, I mean, they'll either come around or they won't. And opinion is interesting, but the fact is, what's wrong with taking care of soil and water? What's wrong with doing a better job farming? All those things are going to be beneficial. And if they can be lucrative enough to support their own costs, then it's just doing business in America from other people's point of view.
And in a way, it's sort of like just making changes that that need to be made or that are like, I saw something that you wrote, Daniel, where in the 1800s, in the early 1900s, communities were able to change because we were starting to have motor cars. So they were able to rebuild the cities to accommodate cars, parking lots, garages, wider roads and all that. And that was because people wanted that, I guess. But at the same time, I think if people start to recognize that what we want is a culture or a society where we're not... you know, where climate change isn't going to kill us all. You know, I mean, it's in a way too bad. What that was like, oh boy, cars, how fun. And now it's like, oh dear, climate change, you know. But at the same time, it is possible to make big changes to the infrastructure.
I think, I don't recall exactly where that anecdote came from. Maybe the Six Foundations for Community Resilience report, but I imagine that's the sort of thing that I would have said to kind of give an example of what's called stranded infrastructure. The point being that once you build something, especially if you're spending billions, if not trillions of dollars on physical infrastructure, you're stuck with it.
Right.
And
that is a problem.
And you set in place a system that is not easily changed. And so that's, so a few things there. I mean, one, that's the system that we're stuck with right now, which is why it's been so hard to even really start the transition to renewable energy.
We're stuck with a motor system.
You cannot really function in this economy as a business, as a household, or anything without interacting with this trillions of dollars worth of investment, infrastructure investment that is entirely oriented on privately owned motor vehicles that run on gasoline. That is not an easy thing to change. So I think the lesson out of that is that, you know, we do collectively control what we can. I was going to say we control our own destiny, and that's kind of loaded, so maybe I won't go there. But, you know, we do make decisions as a society about where we're going to spend our taxes, where we're going to spend our resources, what we're going to build. And we have to live with that. So, you know, we made certain decisions throughout the 20th century that we're having to live with now. And right now, at the beginning of the 21st century, we have an opportunity to make some different decisions to make this transition. And we're going to have to live with those consequences
but
for the next
100 years. But it is possible. That's the sense I get. It is possible to make the changes. I want to just pause a moment and let people know you're tuned to KBOO Portland, the Recovery Zone. Jordan Fink is here, founder of World Tree, and Daniel Lurch, Publications Director for the Post Carbon Institute. We have a caller on the phone, and you can call in with your questions and comments at 503-231-8187. And who is our caller? John, what's up with you?
Hey, what you guys talking? I tuned in a little bit late, so I didn't get the beginning. But you guys are talking about an organization that basically sponsors cooperatives who will put the carbon back into the soil.
That's Jordan Fink here, World Tree.
Good opportunity for a recap.
Yeah, that's right. We're trying to form a cooperative that repairs the planet's soils as quickly as possible, and in small incremental steps that maybe will lead to something large, we hope.
And do you have a website, Jordan?
Oh, our website's worldtree.land. It just got put up, so it's really just like the barest of bones.
And it's actually land.
Yeah, dot
land. Worldtree.land.
L-A-N-D.
So if a person wanted to get involved in this, how would I go about doing this?
Well, you're welcome to get in touch with us. We have a contact form on the website, and I'd love to chat with you. I also have been giving some presentations, and we're going to be getting a little more organized over the next few months, so there'll be more opportunities. We do have a Facebook page as well, so search for the World Tree.
Okay, hold on. I'm legally blind. I got to write down something to...
World Tree Jordan Fink. Google that, and he's all over the place.
World Tree... dot Fink?
Oh, no, worldtree.land.
And, oh, worldtree.land.
And I'm just one of the founders here. I've got a lot of folks that are working with me, and we're all taking on leadership roles in this. So I want to be clear about the fact that I'm not the sole leader of this thing.
No, who would want that?
Right, great. And we have another caller.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Sam, what would you like to say or do?
So... just a practical thing. I've got 4 or 5 acres. Right now it's in Kentucky bluegrass pasture. Oh, nice. And I wonder what's the best way to build carbon and to build soil with that land?
Are you here in the Pacific Northwest?
Yes, I am. I'm in the Columbia River Gorge, and we get about a yard of rain every year.
A yard of rain. Is the land hilly or sloped, or is it lowlands by a stream?
It's almost the banks of the Columbia River.
Right down the way of the banks. That sounds really beautiful. You know, the thing is that there's so many different techniques. There's so many different techniques that you can do. So it sounds like you're trying to keep things in agriculture. Am I right in that?
Yes. Yes, I'm grazing it right now with goats, but they can't keep up with the grass production.
Well, I think that the real expert in thinking through grazing planning for carbon sequestration are the folks connected with Alan Savory and holistic management. And that's a way of thinking about grazing that tries to mimic the way natural herds interact with plants. You know,
I know Alan Savory, and I instituted some of his systems on national forest land.
Oh, that's great. So you're somebody I should work with. The nice thing also is you can be looking at the work of Percival Yeomans. He has a thing called the Key Line Plan, and the purpose with that is to use a certain kind of plow that shatters subsoil and moves water where it needs to go, and that can help increase root depth.
Right.
So subsoil plowing can be useful, and then I think in a lot of other ways, it's just about keeping your eye on it. Do you have suggestions? Because it sounds like you actually have a really good background in this.
So the other thing we have in the gorge is blackberries. They're ubiquitous, and they'll take a piece of land in 2 or 3 years. But I was interested in the cottonwood plantations up by Boardman.
Yeah.
I wondered, do they fix nitrogen? Are they soil builders, or are they just cropping that in a different way?
Well, they produce biomass, and they're definitely there doing photosynthesis. I don't think, every now and then I see on lists for nitrogen-fixing plants cottonwoods, but I have no evidence that I've seen that they actually fix nitrogen. They definitely don't have nodules for nitrogen.
So keeping it in grass pastures is as good as I can do.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's if you look at sequestration rates, some of the peak rates are what's called a silvopastoralism, where you do rows of trees and you do some tree development, but then you also preserve grasslands. And that seems like it's the best of both worlds.
Right.
But the nice thing about bottom-up planning, right, and holistic management is true of this too, is that we need to look at sites specific. Every place has its own needs. And so what are your goals? If your goals really are for something that has to do with woody material, or has something to do with a crop that isn't just grass and cows or grass and goats, then those are probably better decisions for you. You know, it's the solution that meets both the human and the land goals is the one that's going to keep going.
Yeah. We do have another caller.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you a lot. And Joseph, would you like to ask your question? And we're getting low on time here, so.
Yeah, I'll be as real concise, too.
Great.
It's kind of directed towards Mr. Fink. It's in regards to David Millark and Terry Mock, who both work with the Archangel Tree Archive out of Copernicus, Michigan, and the book called The Man Who Planted Trees.
Yeah.
If you get a chance to Google them and reach out to them, share with that we discussed talking on the radio here, it'd be they'd be flattered, but they're doing some work reforesting with giant sequoias and redwoods, which, if I'm not mistaken, sequester about 56,000 metric tons of carbon each. And planted in a forest setting, it actually creates defense shields, et cetera. And they're reforesting and creating archives. The Eden Project is headed by Sir Tim Smith, whom is now signed on with the Chinese with a $100 million project to start an Eden Project similar to the one in Cornwall, England.
And this is the Chinese government?
Yeah, they're becoming so fully aware of how terrible their own environment is that they're now starting. If you Google the Eden Project and see Sir Tim Smith, you'll instantly see a link to the Eden Project work in China, which is really encouraging, but it's so like under the radar.
So this is what I'm discovering, is that there are so many projects that are doing pieces of this.
Right.
It's a shame. There should be somebody like E.O. Wilson that has the website that has like Planet Earth. If you're worried about water, click what organizations are working on water, you know, and not have any BS. The land.land, I'm really encouraged about too, that what you
isn't that nice?
Yeah.
It simplifies things.
There are a lot, and that is a great idea, just getting it all together. Like I was just talking about a place in Portugal called Tamara, where they're doing bioswale work to like really create basically a lot of water in the desert with food forests there. And there's stuff happening. It's just, we've got to find out about it.
On time. The biggest thing for me is starting the reforesting mindset, though, at birth and at the end of life, so that when you pass, you're not leaving a concrete box and a stone or a box and a stone.
That's right.
Reforced. So it's like we're working on projects like that. But if you get in touch, Mr. Fink, with Mr. Millark, we'll touch base down the road.
I'm so excited about that. And you know, one of the things that we don't have very much time to repair repair things.
15-20 at the most.
And one of the reasons why I feel confident about this is because there's so many little seed projects that are already out there. Like what I'm trying to do with World Tree, if nobody else was doing this and I just tried to start what we're doing, it wouldn't happen. But the fact is that we can network existing projects and make them available. There's so many people who want to do this work or can do this work or are doing pieces, and we can all work together, all of these projects.
Thank you kindly for your time, guys, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much, too. And I did want to say one other little fact here, which is if you want to start small and think about your personal impact.
My own backyard?
Yeah. Well, if you want to think about the level, though, of what actually maybe is the minimum we need to take on as individuals, and this is a bit of an issue. If you want to know how much carbon you need to personally sink to take care of 1/7 billionth of the problem.
Right.
And that's saying a lot, because as Westerners, we're actually probably responsible for a lot more than 1/7 billionth of the problem individually. But if you wanted to at least fix that much carbon, that's 600,000 pounds of carbon. So that can be done, but that means that you have to take, no, but using the existing methods we have, that can be done in about half a hectare.
Okay, what's half a hectare? Is that like a tiny bit of an acre or something?
I'm trying to think of conversion.
My backyard.
I think in hectares, so I don't know how to convert that
hectares
to acres.
Hectares, like what, 2.3 acres or something?
Yeah, so that's about an acre. So if you take responsibility for soil production in an acre.
So if I help a farmer who's trying to do this with 2 of his acres.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Then you're taking some responsibility. If you do that through agroforestry, if you do that through good use of biochar, if you use that, if you improve the design of this place, you're taking care of some of that carbon. Now, driving the car to get there,
right,
the actual machinery to do that, you need to compensate a little bit more, but not that much more. If you make good decisions. So one thing, we were talking about a sustainable future. And if you look at like rice paddies in Bali, over, you know, a long period of time, people developed this huge infrastructure of moving water from lakes into ponds, a cultural system of festivals where people just make decisions together of where they put the water. And then building and maintaining of rice paddies. That system took a long time to set up in a complex, amazing culture. But every generation is able to maintain their ponds and maybe build a new pond. There's not enough energy, even in the most sustainable system, to just rapidly colonize an island and transform it. We're in a really weird window, which is we're at peak oil. We still have some energy. That opportunity you were saying that we can still do it has a window, and that window will close.
And we need to use the oil that we have now for doing this kind of thing.
If we're going to use oil
at all,
we need to use it as responsibly as possible while we still have it. But at the same time, other resources of fossil fuels, I do agree, keep it in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to just put in here, I think just what we're just saying is really important to point out, that we need a shift in mentality at a national level, and I'm thinking in particular in terms of our United States history. We've been in frontier mode for the last, you know, few hundred years.
Right.
And like Jordan was saying at the outset, that farmers would come over from Europe and they would farm in New England and they would deplete the soil and they would just keep moving west. And if you have the kind of this endless frontier, or as you think you have this endless frontier, you can do that. It probably even makes economic sense to do that. We're at the end of, we hit the end of frontier some time ago, but you know, we're certainly at the end of it now. So, but our culture has not yet changed. We're still in this depletion mindset.
And
yeah, we're in this depletion mindset. So we need to, and this is a many decades process, we need to change the culture so that we are cultivating this cultural knowledge and these skills that Jordan is talking about.
But I think we're actually at a really interesting point. I think that we're at the point where we can look back at that and say, that's how we did it. I think that we're at the point where we're actually able to now make better decisions and we can move forward on this. I think it's possible for us to come together and transform this stuff in a reasonable amount of time. And that's why I'm approaching all of this with a great amount of hope. I'm over that grief that I was experiencing. I've done my like weeping and my work and my struggle. And I'm at the point now where I think that we are capable of transforming our relationships to the planet and taking responsibility for our connections to one another. And the world that comes out of that is one where there is equality, where there's care for each other, and there's care for the land.
Yeah.
And I do encourage people to come get involved. Right now we're doing a fundraising campaign, and that campaign is you can get to it through
Say some websites again.
The websites to check out are worldtree.land. And we do have a opportunity to donate there. And we're also on GoFundMe, GoFundMe.com, /theworldtree. And please just, you know, come and see what we're up to. Spread the word and help us do this thing. Because we are gearing up for something that hopefully will create opportunities for as many people as possible. And I really thank everybody who is helping spread the word about this and everybody who's getting involved. And thank you so much for this.
And another website you can go to at Post Carbon Institute, we have some of the theory and some of the larger context, and that's at postcarbon.org. And you can also check out a report that we just released called Six Foundations for Building Community Resilience that really tried to take the resilience science. And so these are ways that we try to understand how socio-ecological systems work and how we might be able to work with them and make that applicable to what we can actually do in our own communities. And that's just sixfoundations.org.
Right. And again, it's postcarboninstitute.org.
No, just postcarbon.org.
Postcarbon.org.
Yeah. So right. worldtree.land, postcarbon.org.
Great. So I just want to thank both of you then for being here. It's been really interesting and hopeful, as you say. And I want to let the listeners know you've been hearing from Jordan Fink, who is launching a project called Worldtree to put carbon back into the soil, which could save our whole planet. We could recover. And Daniel Lurch in the post of the Post Carbon Institute. He's the publications director there. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I want to thank Kate Welch for engineering. And thank you for listening and supporting your all-volunteer, non-corporate community station, Radio KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, March 23, 2016. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley are pressing to have $50 million in funds added at the Environmental Protection Agency to allow for more air monitoring and technical assistance for companies seeking to reduce pollution. This is an obvious outcome of recent environmental concerns in Southeast Portland.
Some Oregon commercial property owners could receive between $5 and $10 million annually for allowing wind generating structures on their property, according to a new report from the American Wind Energy Association. Oregon currently produces over 3 megawatts from wind farms in eastern rural Oregon.
The Oregon coastal town of Rockaway Beach appears to hold the record for largest corn dog. Pronto Pup Restaurant had its grand opening on March 19.